Hampshire is a neighboring state to yours, so I presume they know you pretty well. Shouldn't you be winning in New Hampshire?
I've been to New Hampshire a lot. I came here when Gene Shaheen was running for Senate last time, when Maggie Hassan was up for Senate. So I'm back and forth in New Hampshire a lot, and it's been a lot of fun to be here. You know, it's given me a chance to talk about why I'm in this race for president. I see in America, it's working great for rich people. It's working great for the billionaires and the corporate executives and the lobbyists. But it's just not working for much of anyone else.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking on NPR this morning, punting on a question about why her campaign is not doing better in her own backyard. The latest Boston Globe WBZ Suffolk University poll has her tied for fourth among New Hampshire Democratic primary voters, tied with former Vice President Joe Biden and behind Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. So what exactly happened to Warren's campaign? How did it lose momentum? We're going to put that question to Anthony Brooks. He is senior political reporter for WBUR in Warren's home state of Massachusetts, and he's in New Hampshire covering the primary tomorrow. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
All right. Well, let's just begin with that question. What happened to her campaign?
Yeah, it's puzzling because last summer and the early part of the fall, she really was on her way up, and there was sort of an assumption that she was going to surpass Bernie Sanders, and in many polls she did. But then a couple of things happened. I mean, I think when she rolled out her whole Medicare for All plan and when she was sort of perceived as the front runner, she took a lot of fire on that plan. And then she avoided sort of answering direct questions about it. And I think that sort of allowed her to be portrayed a little bit as slippery, maybe. But I think more to the point, she's struggled with Sanders on her left. She's struggled to compete for those diehard progressive voters who have, in a way, come home or stuck with Sanders. And then on the other side, there's Pete Buttigieg, who's drained off a lot of these sort of more educated voters looking for an alternative to Sanders. So she's sort of been boxed in on the one side by Sanders and on the other side by the emergence of Pete Buttigieg. And she hasn't really regained her footing. And had that disappointing finish in Iowa. And if she doesn't finish well in New Hampshire tomorrow, it's going to put her in an even tougher spot.
Well, are you surprised by that? Because you've covered her for a while. And as you said, she was considered the front runner.
I think I am surprised by it because she's a talented politician. It seemed like she has been running a very well-organized campaign. She got on the ground early. She raised a ton of money. She got well organized in states like South Carolina and Iowa. She's been out to Nevada a bunch. And by the way, her campaign continues to say that they have the means and the organization to carry on deep in past Super Tuesday. And so they're sort of putting out the line that, you know, this is going to be a kind of war of attrition for delegates, and she can continue to do it. But I got to say, without winning Iowa, without winning New Hampshire in her own backyard, it's going to be pretty tough. And not a lot of candidates failed to win one of those two early primary or caucus states and went on to get the nomination. Bill Clinton did it in 1992. He didn't win Iowa, then he finished second in New Hampshire, but he finished behind Paul Tsongas, who was sort of a favorite son from Massachusetts. So he was able to spin it as a kind of victory. If Warren finishes third or fourth tomorrow, it's going to be tough for her.
And she's not polling that well in South Carolina either.
No, she's not. Biden still has the lead in South Carolina. And Bernie Sanders has made a lot of inroads with the African-American vote and is doing quite a bit better than Warren in South Carolina. So that might be a challenge for her as well. There's something else, though, that we need to talk about. And that is, I think she has come up against the whole electability issue in a way that might be a bit unfair. I mean, I certainly encountered that across Iowa. Even a lot of women voters saying, well, yeah, I mean, I'm okay with a female president, but I just don't think the rest of the country is. And that was more than an occasional comment that I heard. So given, you know, how well prepared she is and how much experience she has, you know, that's got to be frustrating for her.
So that word electability is really code, right? That I don't think a woman can do it.
Yeah, I think it really is. And if you think about Pete Buttigieg's success, I mean, not to take anything away from him, he's a very talented guy. He's very articulate. He's obviously on his way somewhere, whether it's to the White House, I'm not sure. But imagine if he were a woman, a 38-year-old woman with a very light political resume. I'm not sure that candidate, that female candidate, would be making the kind of progress that Buttigieg is making. So, yeah, I think it is code when they talk about electability. And again, I keep coming back to the same idea. I know that the campaign is frustrated by this.
Well, what about Amy Klobuchar's ascendance, I guess you can call it? She's ahead of Warren in polls in New Hampshire.
It's really interesting because I was just at an Amy Klobuchar event this morning in Keene, New Hampshire, and she is surging. And she is sort of presenting herself as the sort of sensible big tent Midwesterner that might appeal to Democratic voters who don't want to go all the way to the left, to Sanders or even to Warren, and maybe are uncomfortable with Buttigieg. So it's like if Buttigieg is the alternative to Sanders, then Klobuchar is the alternative to the alternative, which is Buttigieg. But yeah, she's really shown, she's really creating a little bit of buzz late in this game. The last local poll that I saw out of the Boston area, out of the Boston Globe, has her in third. And, you know, if she finishes a strong third, you know, just behind Bernie Sanders and Buttigieg, she can credibly claim, she can move on from New Hampshire and credibly claim that, you know, she is a credible alternative with those Midwestern roots and someone who has won in red counties. And it's a compelling argument, and it's sort of a fascinating storyline that is sort of broken late in this New Hampshire campaign.
Anthony Brooks, he is senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. Thank you.
My pleasure, Madeline.
And KCRW will have special coverage of the New Hampshire primary tomorrow night beginning at 5 o'clock. Meanwhile, in Washington, the fallout continues from President Trump's decision to axe two star witnesses in the House impeachment inquiry. Late Friday, the president dismissed his ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who was on the National Security Council, and, for good measure, his twin brother, Eugene Vindman, also on the NSC, but not one of the people who testified. Well, now Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wants every government agency inspector general, and there are about 70 of them, to look into all acts of potential retaliation against whistleblowers. He said the firing of Sondland and Vindman are part of a dangerous growing pattern of retaliation against those who report wrongdoing. Well, here to talk about this is our regular Monday legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hello.
Well, can the president just fire someone like that if he doesn't like what they've said in public testimony?
Well, I would say it's not technically a fire of the Vindman brothers. They're actually being reassigned. So they're still on the government payroll. They still actually are subject to promotions later on. They can still be reviewed and they can be promoted to full colonels. So what they have been is removed, reassigned, but not technically fired. But to your question of basically, can you punish somebody for testifying mm-hmm. under oath and presumably telling the truth, but in a way that the president doesn't like? The answer is probably yes. So these are people who do serve at the pleasure of the president. Now, it feels different, I think, for a lot of people who are thinking about their own workplace and maybe whether or not they can be fired just for telling the truth. But in this case, I think because the president has said, well, I also want to downsize the NSC, because we're not talking about people who are actually whistleblowers and because they weren't actually fired, it's probably permissible.
So it wouldn't fall under the rubric of the National Whistleblowers Protection Act.
So the Whistleblower Protection Act, it protects people who filed a complaint under that act. And that's why, for instance, we don't know the identity of the whistleblower in this case. Now, Congress could, of course, decide to extend it and say it's not just the whistleblower, but it's the penumbra of people around the whistleblower. So it's the people who, like Vindman, testify under oath, subject to basically what comes forward as a result of the complaint. Congress hasn't done that. So I think under a clear reading of the Whistleblower Protection Act, no, they probably don't fall within it.
Nice use of the word penumbra, by the
way.
Thank
you. I've been waiting 2 years for our Monday segment.
It's a very legally word. So what about Schumer's request for these inspectors general to look into this? What could they possibly do?
So I think part of it is just psychological in the sense of saying to all these people who might come forward with future whistleblower complaints, somebody is looking at this, and I don't want you to feel chilled. So, of course, what happens when somebody like Vindman gets reassigned is that other people are worried, well, what if I were to come forward? Or what if I technically wasn't within the Whistleblower Protection Act, but I brought forth some activity that was problematic? What would happen in my case? And I think part of what Schumer's trying to do is say, there are other people in government who are trying to look after you. I also think that he might be exploring strengthening the act, and he really does want to see if there's any other situations of whistleblowers having been retaliated or punished. Mm.
Okay, let's turn to another issue on the minds of we Californians, and that is voting, specifically how to make sure we're able to vote in the upcoming primary. It's fast approaching. Lots of people received their mail-in ballots. I know I did. But some people have not. Why?
Yes. So Tuesday, March 3rd, you don't have to vote by mail. You can go to a voting center. We now open these voting centers for about 10 days in a lot of cases. But if you did not get a vote by mail ballot, that probably means you're not registered as a permanent vote by mail voter and that you're not in one of the areas of the county where you're automatically going to get a vote by mail ballot. Eventually, we're going to roll it out in Los Angeles County. So I believe that everyone will get a mail-in ballot. We're not quite there yet. I think there are about 10 counties in California that are doing that this election cycle. So if you don't have one, you can go to a polling center. You should have gotten a booklet that lists all the polling centers. A lot of them are schools, churches. There should be a bunch within basically 3 miles of wherever you live.
What if you are no party preference and you want to vote in the Democratic primary? What do you do?
Yes. So this is a question of like, what if you're like me, Legal Eagle? I'm a no party preference voter. If you want to vote in the presidential primary, meaning you want to be able to vote for somebody, for instance, who's running in the Democratic primary, then you have to specifically request, if you want to vote by mail, you have to return a ballot that you got from the county registrar or email or call the county registrar and say, I want a ballot with the names of the Democratic presidential candidates. The deadline for that passed, but send it in anyway. It will be processed kind of like a replacement ballot, so you probably will still get your ballot in time. Or go in person. Go to one of these voting centers and say, here's my vote by mail ballot. I didn't fill it out. I'm not trying to vote twice. If you got a vote by mail ballot, can I please have a ballot that has the names of the Democratic candidates? Now, the Republican primary, even though it's not competitive, is closed. So as a no party preference voter, you can't opt into that. Mm. You can vote in the American Independent primary, at the Libertarian primary, or the Democratic primary.
And if you didn't receive anything in the mail and you're no party preference, you can still show up.
Show up. The people there are trained to help you and say, I'm a no party preference voter. I would like this ballot. And if you have any questions, that's why there are trained people who can answer those questions. Exercise your right to vote.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very uplifting. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Coming up, how the Oscars went over with one African-American critic. Hint, not well. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. Oscars so white, Oscars so male, Oscars so Joaquin Phoenix's acceptance speech. And yet, Oscars so parasite and Korean director Bong Joon-ho. Jay Connor was there last night. He's here to share his thoughts on the evening. He's an editor at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Welcome back, Jay.
What up? What up?
How was it? How was it being there?
Very boring, but I definitely have a level of gratitude for being in the building because I understand that a lot of people don't have that privilege. So,
you mean, are you talking about people who weren't nominated? or just regular
That too.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's, speaking of, here's a clip of tape of Steve Martin and Chris Rock not hosting, because there was no host, but they did have a little back and forth.
Cynthia Erivo is here tonight.
Yes! Cynthia Erivo is here tonight. Cynthia did such a great job in Harriet hiding black people that the Academy got her to hide all the black nominees.
Okay, that was a funny joke.
That was a hilarious joke.
Kind of says it all, right?
Yeah. I mean, the beauty of it is that, like, it's so accurate because, like, 18 out of 20 acting nominees last night were white. And, you know, eliminating a race from discussion, you have no women directors that were nominated. Shout out to Natalie Portman's Gown for, you know, giving them some level of recognition. But, I mean, as far as the rest of the show itself, you know, we had Taika Waititi. He became the first person of Indigenous descent to win an Academy Award for writing with Jojo Rabbit. Mm-hmm. It was dope to see Parasite, you know, put some jaws on the floor when it upset 1917 to become the first non-English film and the first South Korean film to win Best Picture. So those were some noteworthy wins. But, I mean, I think that it was kind of, there's a certain level of irony in the fact that we're 80 years removed from Hattie McDaniel winning the first ever Oscar for, you know, a black person. And we have exactly one winner for a black person last night with Hair Love. So we got a long way to go.
And that's an animated short, right? Hair Love?
Yes, it is.
It's not one of the major categories, you know.
Yes.
Let's be honest. And then Eminem performed. Why?
Did you fall asleep with Martin Scorsese? Because I know I got a good laugh when I saw that.
But what was Eminem doing there?
I don't know, but I mean, I think that one thing that people were mentioning that, you know, that was 17 years ago when that song won that award. So it's kind of curious to kind of bring it back. And it's like they had all the time in the world for white males, but it's like they, for whatever reason, they couldn't find any means to recognize any people of color or women throughout the duration of the evening.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Although there were a lot of people of color performing last night.
That there
Janelle
were.
Monáe, Chris Rock, as we just heard.
Definitely. But I mean, I think that it was interesting that POC were, you know, good enough to perform, but not to be nominated, in kind of keeping that in mind. And that we always hear that, you know, there's not a good time to protest. And like, why are you guys doing it at that particular period? But the fact remains that we don't always have the opportunity to speak and address these issues. So I salute both of them for using their platform to address diversity and things of that nature.
But it seems odd to me for the Academy to create this song and dance number complaining about the lack of diversity with Janelle Monáe singing and, you know, all the people on stage representing the actors and the other people who were shut out. It just seems like a way to kind of sanitize the whole thing, to sort of make it acceptable.
That's one way to look at it. But I also think that, you know, anytime you have an opportunity to address these issues, you got to take advantage of it. And I commend, you know, both of them for taking that opportunity to do it, whether it was sanitized or not. You got to, you know, make the most of the situation considering the circumstances.
Yeah. So would you go again?
I hope I don't have to. I hope. I mean, I think that award shows in general can kind of, you know, kind of drone on. And I think that one was, what, 4 hours long? You know what I mean? So I'm good on that. But you never know what will happen in a year from now.
Yeah. Jay Connor is editor at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Jay, thank you.
Thank you, as always.
Coming up, Alison Brie on her new movie, Horse Girl, in which she plays a woman losing touch with reality.
For me, it became this exploration of, like, what is my personal fear of having mental illness in my bloodline? How does that manifest itself through me when I experience bouts of depression, even on a much smaller scale, that can freak me out and kind of go, oh my God, this feels so outside of my control, and that's really scary.
Alison Brie, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've all had dreams that have felt a little too familiar. But what if those dreams become so vivid and so frequent that we can no longer distinguish between them and reality? That's the premise of the new film, Horse Girl.
Like, I've been seeing the same people over and over again in, like, these strange places I've never been before. And I don't know how to describe it. It just feels really weird, like really scary.
It stars Alison Brie. She also co-wrote and produced the film with director Jeff Baena, and they are both with me in the studio now. Welcome.
Hey.
Hi.
Well, first of all, what's a horse girl?
A girl who rides horses and is into horses. People often think that I'm a horse girl. I did not grow up riding horses.
Why do people think you are?
I don't know. I've associated it with my great posture.
You do have great posture.
Thank you. Well, I just kind of sat up straighter as I was saying that. I don't know. This is like an early acting class. I was made right after college. We were all made to walk into the room and introduce ourselves and then turn around with our back to class, and everybody would shout out their first impressions of you. And the first thing that someone said about me is, "Rides horses." I was like, "Oh, thank you."
That could go really in a bad direction.
It was a horrible exercise.
Sounds really, it could be potentially traumatizing.
Yeah, I looked out with ride horses. That was like a pretty nice thing to say.
And you didn't know what it was, Jeff.
Horse girls?
Yeah.
No, actually, I think I told
Oh, you told her.
Well, you were saying you're a horse girl.
No, I didn't say you were a horse girl. I was saying that I would like to do a movie that was investigating this sort of horse girl phenomenon. And then she said that people have accused her of being a horse girl in the past.
See. Not accused.
Yeah. Accused.
That's such an intense word.
You are a horse girl. Well, what is the horse girl phenomenon? And why did you want to explore it?
I think there's like it's now sort of a meme, but I think growing up, there was always a girl or two in your high school or junior high school who somehow had access to horses, would ride them, didn't sort of seem as engaged in anything but the horses at the time. They're always cool, but they just sort of seemed like, you know, they were doing the horse thing. And then that just seems to me like something that was worth investigating.
And it was definitely a girl thing, not a guy thing.
There's horse. I mean, I technically am a horse boy.
You are?
You've ridden much
more
horses than
I grew up riding a lot of
have.
Horses.
So tell me about the character, Sarah, the horse girl.
Yes. Well, Sarah is sort of a former horse girl who's still clinging to her horse girl youth. She is a bit socially isolated. I think that that is something that we took from the horse girl stigma, was like, when I think of horse girls from middle school and high school, they had their own thing going on and they kind of didn't care what other people thought about them. And in Sarah's case, we've taken that to sort of a larger degree, and that now later in her adult life, she has isolated herself through these kind of series of hobbies that she does alone. And she's perfectly content to do those and not have other people really be involved. And that now has become a choice that she's making. There's a great scene when Debbie Ryan, who plays my roommate, first comes in and is saying, you know, my boyfriend's roommate is single, but I could introduce you. And Sarah's very indifferent to it, when you might think meeting her in the movie, she could use a boyfriend,
mm-hmm. but she seems sort lonely.
She seems a little lonely, but she's actually not. She really likes her
she's like made
supernatural
a world for herself.
Shows uh-huh. and her crafts that she does. Yeah, she likes her life the way it is.
So she's likable, but she likes
I hope so.
Yeah, and you think, oh, why doesn't she have friends? Why doesn't she have a boyfriend? And then some guy is interested in her. So she does actually get together with her roommate's boyfriend's
yes.
roommate.
Roommate's boyfriend's
her roommate.
Roommate's
yeah. boyfriend's roommate.
Let's get that straight.
Played by John Reynolds. And that's a very sweet. I love the romantic storyline in this movie, even if it turns out a little tragic.
A little weird. We have a clip. We have a scene from, I guess it's their first date.
Yeah.
Where they're having dinner. And she figures out that he's into this paranormal stuff that she's really into.
Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, folklore comes from somewhere. So at some point, someone saw a Bigfoot.
Someone saw it, exactly. They saw it. And then they knew that the aliens were using the humans as thermometers and bringing them back up and like downloading all the information to learn about our planet, you know?
Totally.
And they could even be using human clones because that would give them more reliable information, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So he thinks she's talking about something in a fun way, but she's really serious.
At this point, I mean, this is sort of one of those classic first date scenarios where both people are trying to impress the other person and you're kind of just agreeing with them and you're getting to know them still. And these two people in particular are kind of shy, kind of sweet, agreeable. Of course, for Sarah, at this point in the movie, not a lot of people are believing what she's saying. And again, because she's such a shy person, it takes so much courage even to bring up some of the ideas that she's talking about in the movie. Things like aliens, she realizes that's a taboo thing to talk about. And when people don't respond, she's quick to shut it down immediately because it's already so embarrassing. So the fact that this guy is engaging in that conversation at all is so exciting and validating for her. Meanwhile, for him, he just thinks they're having kind of a silly conversation.
He's just yes-anding her the whole time. I mean, it's right. Just so much easier when people are going off having a surface conversation to saying yes to it instead of
like challenging.
Yeah, he's not going to challenge her. And he's also in his head too. I mean, so he just feels attracted to her and he's just trying to keep the conversation going.
Yeah, he also seems like a really lonely character.
He definitely is a little bit of a lonely character because he just went through this breakup and he's living with a new roommate. I mean, both characters, Sarah and Darren, both live with roommates who aren't really good fits for them. They're not like best friends. They're sort of just a means to an end as a roommate. And I think that adds a little to their loneliness.
So when you were directing this, and how did you want to portray the evolution, or should I say the de-evolution of Sarah?
I wanted to make sure it was always that the elements that I think later kind of become inflated were always there from the beginning. So that if you go back and watch it from the top, there's always elements of sort of sadness and confusion and isolation. But I also wanted to sort of play into the idea that what we're watching isn't some weird dark horror movie, but it's something that's more psychological and personal. So I wanted to see it through her eyes and see it unfold as it's happening to her. And so I don't want to stack the deck in any way whatsoever. I wanted to leave some freedom to the audience for sort of some amount of interpretation that could go either way. We have a particular take on it, but we don't want to spoon feed it to people. And I like the idea of some amount of mystery because things aren't answered for you in real life. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to sort of keep that sort of ambiguity, that gray area alive throughout. But we wanted to make sure that it does track and that the things that we wanted to make sure were in there are in there.
Definitely. I think our biggest objective was that the audience is going for the ride with Sarah, with the character, not standing back and judging her, but is put in a place to not know the way that she's uncertain of what's actually happening. The audience should be equally uncertain. And certainly just in hearing feedback from the few that have seen the movie already, it's proving to be that way.
But it does bring up some issues that in real life we're really cognizant of now, maybe more than we have been in the recent past, and that is the prevalence of the mentally ill on our streets, the homeless, the homeless mentally ill. And you do touch on that in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the impetus for writing this is that my grandmother, my mom's mother, suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, and she was homeless. She died as a homeless woman living in Santa Monica. And it's
Did you know her?
I did not really know her, but I grew up, I mean, I met her a couple times and I saw her before she died, but I really grew up with this mythology of her and hearing my mother tell all these different stories of her upbringing, living with a person going through this thing. So for me, it became this exploration of like, what is my personal fear of having mental illness in my bloodline? How does that manifest itself through me when I experience bouts of depression, even on a much smaller scale, that can freak me out and kind of go, oh my God, this feels so outside of my control. And that's really scary, which I guess got me thinking just to the idea of how the most terrifying thing might be not being able to trust your own mind or having a disease that's living inside of your genetic makeup that is just out of your control. Mm. And yeah, I think that that sort of was a jumping off point in what we wanted to explore.
Your grandmother, was she treated or did she go off her medication? Or?
Well, that's the thing. When, you know, she wasn't diagnosed for a long time because at that time people weren't treating that disease. And she was more getting, you know, uppers in the morning to wake up and very intense downers at night to go to sleep. And that's the medication she was given by her doctor in the 40s and 50s. It was not to treat mental illness. I think a lot of people, it was very stigmatized. It was very embarrassing to the family. Money was thrown at it. I mean, that's something we see with, again, with Sarah in this movie. that she's just, she feels so embarrassed and ashamed to even talk about it with people. So she's so isolated throughout the movie. Something that's better now, especially when I talk to people who have family members who are suffering from mental illness, is that it is treatable now, and that there are medications people can take, and people can live with these diseases and have a real awareness that they have them. My grandmother didn't have that luxury, and my family didn't have the resources to take care of her. She was hospitalized, but a lot of the mental institutions were closed, shut down in the 80s, lost funding.
By Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
It was by Reagan. I wasn't going to say it, but it was by Reagan. And from then on, she did live on the street. And our family just, you know, there was a lot of complicated things going on. But ultimately, it was a resource issue, and it was difficult to care for her.
It's an incredibly sad story.
It is.
And incredibly relevant.
Definitely. I think what's nice about living now is that you see this trend even on, or especially on maybe social media, where people have been so open now about mental illness or about seeking help, about even just going to therapy, which, you know, 20, 30 years ago was a taboo even to just talk about going to therapy. And now you see a lot of like celebrity voices who talk openly about their depression, their anxiety. And I think that's a really great step forward.
So that was the through line, or that was the backbone of this.
Definitely.
This movie was your real life experience and your real life fear that you could have something of that in you.
Yeah.
Let me just play another clip of tape of your character, Sarah, describing her grandmother.
People always said that my grandma was so crazy. Like, she was like talking to the walls, and like she was hearing voices. She thought she was from the future.
Yeah.
And she was super paranoid. And like, now I think that maybe she wasn't crazy at all, because I'm feeling it, like the same thing's happening to me.
I think what's so great about that scene is that it is redefining the word crazy, and that it is open to interpretation.
Yeah, definitely. That scene, maybe more than any other scene, has the most sort of personal through line to myself and my story. I feel like we tap into certainly some very real emotion. And even that clip, you know, the stories that I grew up hearing were about my grandmother talking to the walls. And sometimes, you know, these stories were told even in a slightly humorous fashion, and that's how my mother would cope with the trauma. And other times there was a way of making us understand how traumatic it really was. But certainly when you're looking at something secondhand, yes, there can be a judgment or a thing that's put on. We throw around the word crazy a lot, and it doesn't really do justice to the thing that people are going through. And certainly we wanted to look at this character with a lot of empathy.
Yeah, it's really dismissive just to say, oh, they're just crazy, you know, because they're an actual person. Mm-hmm. They're experiencing life like you are. Like, all you have is stimuli coming in and your processing of it, and that's pretty much your experience of the world. And to judge those people and basically write them off as being crazy, I think, is sort of doing them a massive disservice, and just basically like counting them out as people. Like, everything has been consistent for people that aren't considered crazy for so long, and then when it isn't, then are you crazy? Then should you just be like thrown away into the trash? Like, it's, to me, that's crazy.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
And good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The movie is called Horse Girl. You can find it on Netflix. Allison Brie, Jeff Baena, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Steve Chiatakis joins me now for a preview of Greater LA coming up in about 20 minutes from now.
Legal recreational weed has been obviously the law of the land in California for the past 2 years, right? Uh-huh. It's very difficult to get a license to sell it, though, recreationally. Very difficult.
And weren't some people supposed to be given preference to get those
licenses? Yes, people with a criminal justice background, obviously a judicial background because of, you know, arrests made earlier in life. So we talked to some people like that, and why the illicit market is so big 2 years later coming up.
All right. That'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
And
it's an ongoing story, something that we're covering.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. That's coming up at 1 o'clock, Greater LA with Steve Chiatakis. Coming up, the photographer who captured the Laurel Canyon music scene and so much more next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Rolling Stones, Joni Mitchell, Linda Ronstadt, Neil Young, Frank Zappa, and so many more all stepped in front of Henry Diltz's camera. You have definitely seen some of these photographs. Diltz was the official photographer for historic concerts like Woodstock and Monterey Pop. His archive is set to feature more than 800,000 photos of iconic musicians. One of the most famous shots is turning 50 years old this year, the cover photo for The Doors' 1970 album Morrison Hotel. It was shot in downtown L.A. Diltz owns a gallery of the same name, the Morrison Hotel Gallery. It's in West Hollywood. That gallery is also celebrating an anniversary this month, 20 years of operation. And photographer Henry Diltz joins me now in the studio to talk about this. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk about that photo, the Morrison Hotel photo.
Yes.
How did that come to be?
Well, that I worked with a really great graphic artist named Gary Burden, and we had just done the Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, Sitting on the Couch. Mm-hmm. And I think The Doors saw that, and they called us and said, we want you to do our next album cover. So we went over to their little sort of clubhouse office, and we met Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison there. I'd known them around town. But we said, okay, do you have a title? And they said, no. We said, well, do you have some idea what you want on the cover? They said, no. And then we're scratching our heads, kind of thinking, what's next? And then Ray Manzarek just spoke up randomly, and he said, you know, my wife Dorothy and I were driving through downtown L.A. the other day. We saw this funky old hotel called Morrison Hotel. And we just said, wow, that sounds so perfect. And we went down that very day in their Volkswagen van, the four of us, and there it was. And we walked in and checked it out. Came back a week later with the band. Mm-hmm. And we walked right in, walked into the lobby. There was a young guy behind the desk. I said, oh, we're just going to be over there taking photos. Nobody was in the lobby. And it really was kind of a flop house, you know.
Uh-huh. Like an SRO more than a real hotel.
Yeah, rooms $2.50
Oh.
It said on the sign. So I said, we'll just be over there taking pictures. He said, no, you can't take any pictures unless you get the landlord's permission. So I said, okay, guys, we're going to have to walk outside and stand in front of the window. They can't stop us. And I walked out, and then I saw a light go on through the window. I looked through the window. I said, that's the elevator light. The guy left the desk. Quick, you guys, run in there. And they ran in, jumped behind the window, click, 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 one roll of film, and we got out of there.
And did you know, you had probably no idea at the time that this would become an iconic photo for an iconic album, for an iconic band?
Not at all. And I mean, I was standing right next to the window when they ran in there. So I was right up next to it, getting not the whole name, but just kind of getting them from the side. And as usual, my graphic artist partner, Gary, said, back up, get the whole window. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a thought in mind. And he always would say to me, just shoot everything that happens. Film's the cheapest part. This was in the film days.
And were you professionally trained at all in being a photographer?
No. I was a banjo player in a folk group. And one morning on the road, leaving East Lansing, Michigan, we went into a secondhand store, and there was a table full of secondhand cameras. And the guy in front of me in the group said, oh, a camera, I'll have one. And then I thought, yeah, why not? Me too. Grabbed a camera, and, you know, that was it. Total accident.
And that was it because you immediately fell in love with photography?
Well, no. The same guy in the group, that's Cyrus Farrier, the leader of the group, he said, pull into the next drugstore, I'll buy film. And we took pictures for the next week or two on the road, got back to L.A., developed the film, and lo and behold, they were little slides, little transparencies. I had no idea. I never thought about what it was going to look like. And so I said, well, let's have a slideshow. And when I saw that first picture hit the wall, glowing in the dark, 8 feet wide, it just blew me away. It was absolute magic.
What was that photo of?
Oh, it was a picture of us on the road. I think it was the bass player blew his bass case up with M80 firecrackers. He had an old cardboard bass case. We were in the desert in Arizona. and he filled it full of firecrackers, and it blew up in the air, and he was running away in the background, and I got that picture. And to see that, you know, and to be there back in that moment was amazing, and to share it with all my hippie friends was amazing.
Do you still have that photo?
Oh, I do, yes. And
but did you think, I think I can do this for a living, when you saw that photo?
No, I did it just so I could have more slideshows with all of my friends. So I was photographing all my friends in Laurel Canyon who were fellow musicians, like David Crosby, Stephen Stills, Mama Cass. All those people were my friends. I knew them first as a musician. And so I would take their pictures and close friends of mine, the other people in the group, so we could have a weekend slideshow. And then accidentally one got used in a magazine, and they paid me $100, and I thought, wow, that was the second epiphany. The first epiphany was seeing that 8-foot picture glowing in the dark. The second epiphany was that somebody would pay me something to use one of these, you know.
What was that photo?
It was the Buffalo Springfield outside of a folk club in Huntington Beach. And actually, I went with them to the sound check and went down to the beach to take pictures of people on the beach. And I got a great shot of a guy with a monkey on his shoulder. For a long time, it was my favorite, the slide. And I walked back to the club, and I was just taking a photo of a huge mural on the back of the club. It was like 2 stories high. It was a guy riding a bicycle with a pink backdrop. And the back door opened, and the Buffalo Springfield came out. And I said, hey, stand there a minute, you guys, so I can show how big that mural is. And they said,
because you were more interested in the mural than
well,
them.
Well, yeah, yeah. And so it was my accidental first real group shot, you know.
Well, how did the bands and the artists respond to you always taking photos of them? Did they think it was okay? Did they ever think it was intrusive?
You know, I think they didn't notice. I'm more of a documentary type of guy, and I'm fascinated by people. So I don't jump in there and you know, take over. Because I don't want to make a photo. I want to photograph something that's really happening. So they didn't really notice me as a photographer because of that, and because I was really a musician friend. And musicians, it's a kind of it's a club, really. You know, we all know each other, and we all kind of hang out. And musicians hang out for, you know, 3/4 of their life. And I'm good at that. And I would just hang out until I saw something I wanted to photograph, and then very quietly take it.
You know. What do you think your photos did for creating the, I don't want to say myth, but there is definitely a larger-than-life aspect of the Laurel Canyon music scene.
Yeah, Laurel Canyon. Yeah, it's kind of a mythological, like sort of like Camelot or something. Yeah. I mean, it's become that around the country. And what is it, really? Laurel Canyon is just the hills above Hollywood with little twisty, curvy roads, and I lived up there for 20 years. So I guess I was kind of just the observer somehow. You know, since I was right there in the middle of it and knew all these people, and there weren't many photographers, really. So, I saved all those moments, and then other people saw them. Now, you know, people come up to me today and say, thank you so much for taking those photos. And I say, well, that's very nice of you. Thank you. And then I walk away and I think, well, gosh, I took those pictures for myself, really. I mean, every one of them was just me doing what I wanted to do, kind of remembering that scene or that moment or... You know, and by the way, all these people I photographed are, I'm a huge fan of all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, gosh, I mean, I sang in a group that was a 4-part harmony group, the Modern Folk Quartet. So hanging out with Crosby, Stills, Nash, hanging out with the Eagles, you know, hearing that harmony, love that. And singer-songwriters, that's what happened in Laurel Canyon from the folk days. In the early 60s to the late 60s, early 70s were singer-songwriters. You know, because before that, there were songwriters and there were singers. Mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra never wrote any songs.
Right. Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley never wrote any songs. So what happened with, you know, I think the Beatles playing on Ed Sullivan and all the folk groups watched that and went electric the next week and got a drummer and started writing their own songs. People like Joni Mitchell and Stephen Stills, Neil Young, all those people. Jackson Brown. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Jackson Brown. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Webb, one of my favorite songwriters. All these people. So I'm thrilled to be there doing this, you know, quietly. But I'm kind of like a little kid who's climbed under the circus tent, you know. And I get to stand there and marvel at everything.
So what changed for you when you stopped photographing the Laurel Canyon scene and started photographing later music trends and other bands that perhaps you didn't know them personally? What was that different to photograph, let's say, a heavy metal group and you didn't necessarily know the members of the group personally?
Well, not visually. You know, it's not hanging out with your friends so much. But by then, I guess I was, you know, kind of a professional. I don't know, people would say, oh, you're a photographer. Are you a professional? And I would say, no, I still say that, you know, it's just something I do. It's something I love to do, you know. And then one day somebody said, oh, you must have quite an archive. You know, that was like in the 90s. And that, oh, archive sounds a little too professional. I do have a lot of boxes full of photos and negatives, though. And sure enough, after 50, 55 years, I started in 66. So after over 50 years, I did have an archive of all these photos, something I never thought. People say, oh, did you realize you had a... No, never once. Every day I got up in Laurel Canyon, you know, did what we did in the morning, lit incense, you know, listened to Ravi Shankar, went off into the day to see what kind of adventure would happen. And I never once thought, boy, someday, you know, this picture or I will have this history of photos. Never once occurred to me that I would have some kind of a collected history. But it did happen.
And now how many photos do you have?
Well, it's approaching a million, I'm sure.
Oh my gosh.
With black and white and color. And it's not all music. It's about half music. I take at least 100 pictures a day.
To this day?
Well, I've taken 50 pictures here in the NPR building, you know.
What? I didn't even notice.
Oh, well, I've been walking around photographing the furniture and the signs and sneaking pictures of people. Yeah, I'm stealthy.
And what are you going to do with these photos? I see your camera's right here. I just noticed it.
Yeah, my little pocket camera, yeah. But this little tiny Canon camera has a 600-millimeter lens. That's like a sports lens, like at a football game. And you can get a headshot of a person way over on the other side of the room. It's an amazing little machine.
Is there anyone you always wanted to photograph but couldn't or didn't?
Well, you know, my single answer to that is John Lennon. I never did photograph the Beatles, but in the years past since the Beatles, I've photographed Paul McCartney a lot, Ringo, I've been on the road with him, and George a little bit at the concert for Bangladesh, but never photographed John Lennon. Mm. But no, I'm happy with whom I've photographed and whom I'm photographing and will photograph.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you in. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madeline. My pleasure.
Henry Diltz, he's a legendary music photographer, and you can visit his gallery. It's called the Morrison Hotel Gallery. It's inside the Sunset Marquee, just off the Sunset Strip. I'll keep your eyes on the road, you hand upon the wheel. Michelle Aloys here with some listener feedback. I just have to tell you that he took that camera out and was photographing all sorts of people here.
Oh, yeah.
In KCRW because he keeps these collections.
I sat in that interview and I remember him saying that he had taken some photos of some
clandestine
photos. That they don't know. So maybe their face will be featured in his next anthology of photos.
Or on the cover of an album or something. Who knows?
Exactly.
Do we have feedback today or no?
We have a little, yeah. We asked people if they watched the Oscars and who they thought got snubbed, who they thought, you know, deserved the win. Gotcha Punky just says no. Very helpful answer. Thank you. Colin T. Black says there are so many ways to build racial resentment in the world. Perhaps we should try a little bit harder to avoid stoking unnecessary embers. We had a lot of the people who did win, though, on the show.
On the show earlier, yeah.
Yeah, so, we had Bong Joon-ho, who took home, I can't remember how many. It just seemed like he was up there over and over and over again.
Well, best director, best
exactly.
picture.
You can check out that
best
interview.
Screenplay.
We had Hilda Gudnadottir, the
composer.
Man. Composer, yes.
For Joker.
Exactly. I'm blanking on who else we had, but I know we had more.
We had American Factory.
Antonio Banderas, nominee.
Did not win.
Winner. Bummer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Michelle Alloy. And thank you for your feedback. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.